Hey, idiots! I'm Jessica Michelle Singleton. I'm a stand-up comedian, and I'm also an idiot sometimes. Aren't we all? If you love to laugh as much as you love to learn about new people, I have a podcast for you called Hey Idiots. It's 50% hilarity, 50% curiosity, and 100% insanity. My guests include experts in their field, sometimes just other stand-up comedian friends, and occasionally absolutely insane people who have somehow convinced me they're knowledgeable about a topic. If you're into expanding your mind or just laughing out loud, check out the Hey Idiots podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
As always, this is somehow a book podcast.
Yeah.
It's called Edging. I think you know that because you've probably typed something in or you can see it. Unless we're just getting played at like an Applebee's.
I hope we get played at Applebee's.
Applebee's,
if you're listening, specifically the Applebee's in Winchester, Kentucky, I'm a big fan. You do great work, and I'd love to get myself on that big screen.
Your tequila makes my shoulder hurt, so I don't trust the Dollaritas, but I do love all of your monthly drink specials.
Yeah, and the tacos, whatever.
Chicken wonton tacos.
Yeah, those are freaking, I mean, my compliments to the chef. Those are so good. Mwah.
We could, I mean, it wouldn't be that hard to find somebody that works at Applebee's, right?
You might be able to hook us up, Ian, because you probably can find out through being from here who works there.
I used to know lots of people when I was younger that were like on the wait staff and everything, but I don't know now.
This brings up something that I've actually wanted to talk about. I thought about this yesterday. Ian, you used to deliver pizzas.
I did.
Okay. So I was listening to my brother and me yesterday, and they have a segment where they talk about what like restaurants are announcing as their promos. They talk about the press releases that restaurants put out because they're always really something. And recently Pizza Hut did a thing for Valentine's Day where...
Were they doing the heart-shaped pizza again?
No.
No.
Where they were doing a pizza to break up with someone.
Okay.
So it's a pizza and there's like a place to write a note. And it's like the net positive here is that, I mean, being broken up with is hard, but having a pizza would be better than not having one.
Better than getting it by text. You don't get shit when you get a text.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then they brought up a point that I was like, well, we got to talk about this. You're sending that pizza to someone who didn't order a pizza. The delivery person... Mm. Is going to someone's house who didn't order a pizza The pizza is breaking up with them. As a former Pizza Hut delivery driver, how does that feel?
I don't like that. Because All right. So if you're breaking up with someone, it's not always the case, I guess. But I would imagine that there's already been some arguing, fighting, something going on, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you're choosing to do it today, that's probably, I don't know, maybe not, I don't know. But maybe that stuff's happened recently, this person's already in a bad mood, you show up at their door and they're like, what do you want? And you're like, I have this horrific pizza for you. Now, ideally, you can just hand them the pizza, say, hey, it's paid for, and just walk away, right?
Yeah.
And then if they open it up and they're like, hey, I have some questions, you can be like, that's a shame, and then just get in the car and go, you know? I don't like that at all.
I mean, you got to imagine we do live in a world of contactless delivery.
I was going to say, at least nowadays when you get food delivered, it's not like the guy doesn't knock on the door and wait.
That's true. That was my experience like 20 years ago, but yeah that should not, that should be a requirement, right?
Yeah. You can't
put some, I mean, like, you could be like putting someone in danger.
Yeah.
You know, doing that.
Well, because someone could like be in a place where like they're not really thinking about the pizza delivery person.
Well, I'm thinking about like delivering it to women because I've always dated women and broken up with women. But like you could be delivering that to a man who's going to do like a violent, crazy thing. You know?
Could be the in between with an abusive partner and not know.
Yeah.
Because there's just like.
Oh, yeah. You could be like delivering the abuse.
Yeah. Ew. Or you could be delivering the breakup to the abuser. All bad.
Right, yeah.
All not great for our delivery person.
Yeah. So Pizza Hut, if you are listening, it's a bad idea.
We know you are.
I know that we know that you are, first of all. So eyes on us.
Mm-hmm. Eyes up here.
Ears on us.
We know that you don't give a shit about your delivery drivers.
Yeah.
Not in a special way, but in the way that any corporation gives a shit about its entry-level employees, right? But don't hurt them, right? Don't actively try and hurt them.
This doesn't feel like indifference, Pizza Hut. This feels like you're mad.
Just do the little, well, Pizza Hut can't do this, but the little feed a roach thing or whatever that your local zoo will do.
Yeah, I mean, like, yeah, at least the roach is going to get fed to the lizard anyway. Can you imagine?
You don't want to feed a delivery boy.
Also, if you're doing the thing like, if I find out that someone I've dated called a zoo to have them name a roach after me and then feed it to a lizard.
Wow.
I will never feel like I have won a breakup so much as I will feel like I've won the breakup.
Yeah.
If that's what happens. You know, like that's honestly just real validation that this was the right choice.
Yeah.
This was the right choice. Speaking of the right choices, I made a bad choice when I was trying to figure out my book to do this week. So as always, I was just letting Audible suggest books to me. And sometimes I like type in scary or horror or something like that. And like we've talked about before, it's been giving me these like bad recommendations lately.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're all like, I won't say bad. They're not bad books, but they're not what I'm looking for, right?
Yeah.
They're like thrillers, they're mysteries, which are great. Love them. But, you know, we're doing horror books and we're doing romance books, and they're not really like fitting the bill, right?
They're not either of those.
They're not either of those. Yeah. Yeah. I've enjoyed them. I've listened to them. I've enjoyed them. I did not enjoy this one. So I know that in the past, I've made this promise like several times because I'm such a slow reader, slow note taker, slow typer. When I'm making my little outline here, if I read it, I'm doing it because the time has been spent, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm once again lying, and I am not doing this book. It was so bad, you all. There wouldn't have been anything to talk about because nothing much happened. I think I got probably halfway through it. And it started with a good premise. It was like a cozy ghost story is what I thought it was going to be, right? Oh my God, what a slog. Like,
oh man.
This, okay, I'm not going to say too much about it because I don't want to like shit on it and then just move on and no redeeming, because that's not what we're trying to do here. But there was this romance going on, which is great. Love a mystery with a romance. Mm-hmm. Love a horror story with a romance. Both of these characters were the most insufferable people. And they're trying to be very like, it's like the man is like, everything he says is like the most profound thing you've ever heard.
God.
It's going to like change your life, you know? It's the way that like 2000s indie movies. He was a pixie dream guy.
Yeah.
He was a pixie dream guy. Except he was like kind of scary.
Yeah.
I don't know.
They usually are.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah. So anyway, zero stars for the book that we're not talking about today. Not going to name it, but. You know, good fucking riddance. So anyway, I'm saying all this because I found another book afterwards and I paid an extra $15 on top of my like monthly Audible credit that I get because I saw it and it looked really good. And what drew this book to me, well, we'll talk about that in a minute, but I was going through it and I was listening to it and there is this great quote. Oh my God, this guy is just like so good at... Mm-hmm. Just these little passages and these lines. We'll get into it. But I recorded one of them. I screen recorded one of them and sent it to my friend Catherine. And where I'm screen recording it, there's the cover image, right? Mm-hmm. Which I'll show you all in a second. And the author's name was John Darnielle. And she was like, is that the guy from the Mountain Goats? Like the band, the Mountain Goats? And I looked it up and it's the guy from the Mountain Goats.
I love the Mountain Goats.
Yeah,
this that's so pure.
This book is written by...
The Mountain Goats.
Yeah, the guy from the Mountain Goats. And mm-hmm. Holy shit, did I make the right call by not doing the other book and doing this one instead? Y'all are going to have so much fun today.
$15 well spent.
$15 well spent. Before I give you the cover, I'm going to tell you the name. Can you guess what it's going to be about? It's one of my favorite things. The book is called Devil House.
Satanic Panic.
It's Satanic Panic.
Satanic Panic.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, God, I love a Satanic Panic story.
You really do.
I grew up in it. You know?
Were part of this Satanic Panic.
I was
panic.
A little Christian boy during the Satanic Panic. And
I love that because you're the same age as my older brother, and he was on the other, and he was the satanic kid.
Yeah.
And you were the Christian boy trying to reach out to the satanic kids.
So I was the Christian boy that, here's the thing about the Satanic Panic and why it works so well, is because when you grow up in that environment and it's repressed from you, mm-hmm. yeah, that dark side is just so alluring, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. So... yeah, it's so like I was a little Satanic Panic kid, but also like I like secretly like listened to Metallica and like there's like a Marilyn Manson video would be on. I'm like, God, this is horrible, but man, it sounds so fucking good.
Yeah.
Man, that's a good song. I wish I could enjoy it without the guilt.
Yeah. I remember my dad would call it with my older brother, which everything he did I thought was the coolest thing, my brother Eric. But whenever Dad would get mad about his music being too loud, no matter what it was, he'd yell, "Eric, turn that Marilyn Manson shit off." And there was one time, it was literally, we were like, "Dad, that's Sugar Ray." Like, I don't know why you
that's
were
so, funny.
So upset about this.
I wish that a recording of your dad saying that existed.
It probably does somewhere. We had a video camera and we got a lot of stuff videotape, but my brother loved all this like heavily satanic music, and then just like actual they're playing off of the satanic stuff in a lot of the bands that he liked, and then he also liked regular metal, and then he also liked Sugar Ray and other just like chill,
who doesn't like Sugar
Ray, 90s stuff. But no matter what it was, even if my dad would actually like it, he would just accuse it of being Marilyn Manson.
What I should point out, too, I know I'm talking about the Satanic Panic, and I was born in the 80s, I grew up in the 90s, and the Satanic Panic, as we understand it, had mostly passed by then,
mm-hmm.
but in small-town America, especially in the Midwest and the South, it never went away.
Yeah.
So it's
we're
like,
still in it.
Yeah, it's just QAnon now.
Yeah.
So, Bridget, this is the cover of our book.
Okay, so I really love this style. It reminds me of old school Stephen King, as well as Late Night with the Devil, a recent movie that is set in a 1970s night show. It is, the top is black, at the bottom is white. In red, it says Devil House. In white, it says New York Times bestseller, by the way. So we're getting a good thing out of this. And it is a house on the black part of it that's white. And then on the flip part, the bottom part, it's white. And the bottom of the house, the shadow of the house, is creating like a little devil-looking thing, like an upside-down kind of devilish face.
It's like in negative, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love this.
And it says on there, from Dwight Garner of the New York Times, "It's never quite the book you think it is. It's better."
Ooh.
All right, I'm going to read the synopsis to you. Gage Chandler is descended from kings. That's what his mother always told him. Now he's a true crime writer with one grisly success and movie adaptation to his name, along with a series of subsequently lesser efforts that have paid the bills, but not much more. But now he's being offered the chance for a big break, to move into the house where the locals call it the Devil House, in which briefly a notorious pair of murders occurred, apparently the work of disaffected 1980s teens. He begins his research with diligence and enthusiasm, but soon the story leads him into a puzzle he never expected, back to his own work and what it means, back to the very core of what he does and who he is. So we love it. We love a good story that wraps you back around.
Yeah.
To the we're just going to get into it.
This
really
is
good.
Also very you in the sense that besides the Satanic Panic, I feel like a lot of what you write is you returning home.
Yeah, it yeah. really is. There's a lot of going home.
That's good, Bridget.
That's true.
We got to clip that out. Also, I would like to say that based on the cover and the description, I think we should rate it in slices of pizza.
Okay.
And I would give this a full pizza.
Oh, I forgot we were talking about pizza. I was like, where'd that come from? Okay. Yeah.
I would do, yeah. Well, but I'm going off of, are we going off of the inlet too?
You mean like
the description? Yeah.
Yeah, sure. All of it.
Okay, then yeah, full pizza. I like, as much as I love the cover, if I just saw the cover, I might, because sometimes I am awful for like, oh, this is probably dated. I would have thought yes. it was from the 70s.
The cover looks like Black Christmas. It looks like one of those old mm-hmm. horror movies. It looks so good. And I think also, if I didn't know it was a more modern book, I might be worried it was older. Mm-hmm. And that would put me off it.
Yeah, it doesn't look like a new book. And I guess it's like middle 2000s. It's not yeah. super new. It's like 10 years old, probably. Maybe less than that. But it's pre-COVID for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Are we guys ready?
I'm Let's ready. Go.
Well, too fucking bad. It's an ad break.
Oh. Fuck.
Okay. We're back and we're talking about Devil House by John Darnielle. So this is going to be like several stories in one book, and that can be done really well or it can be done really poorly. And in this book, it's done really, really well. So there's a couple stories that happen in parallel in this book. I'm going to mainly focus on the Devil House story, but there's another story there's several different things. We're going to go through them all a little bit, but we're mostly going to stick with the Devil House murder. So if you do pick this book up, you get a lot of stories that we're not going to really cover here in very much detail. So I love this thing so much. Can't say enough. Okay. We're going to bounce around in time a little bit too. There's going to be some stuff from the 70s, from the 80s, and from the author's present, which in this book is going to be the year 2002. Something that John Darnielle is really good at is keeping you guessing about who is and who is, or like, you know, who's who in this story, right? So who's the victim? Who's the killer? Who's guilty? Who's innocent? We're going to revisit that several different times. This book is broken up into four parts, and I actually caught on to that this time. Normally, I find out that a book has parts when I get to part two.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, there's parts. Cool. It's a surprise, but this one has four parts. And our story is going to begin with a first-person narrator. His name is Gage, and he writes true crime books. His first one was called The White Witch of Morro Bay. Now, this is like a fictional true crime, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like Olive Hill. It's a fictional true crime.
Fake true crime.
None of us can talk today.
If you're coming awesome. Here from Olive Hill and this is your first time learning that Olive Hill is not a real story, welcome.
Please stop.
It is fictional.
Please stop calling the Olive Hill Sheriff Department.
they don't know what you're talking about.
All right. In the this first book that he wrote, it was actually about his hometown ghost story, the one that like haunted his childhood, and it's the legend, but then it's like the true story that inspired it, right? So in the town legend, the one that he grew up with, that all the kids his age knew, the White Witch of Morro Bay had been a teacher at the high school. And as like the ghost stories went, she lured young men to her big house by the water, getting them drunk and then like draining their blood. But in real life, she didn't live in a big house by the bay. She lived in an apartment near the beach in San Luis Obispo. And she didn't lure dozens of young men. She only killed two of them. Both of them were boys. Both of them were students of hers. They were like actually in her class, and they came to her apartment. They came to her apartment and they tried to rob her, but she was actually able to like get a hold of a knife, and she stuck one of them in the eye, and the other boy was like frozen in fear, standing at like his friend's side, like while blood is spurting from his eyeball. And she like takes her opportunity, jumps on him and like stabs him three times in the neck.
That's always the thing of like, I know there's some TikTok sound that's like, you're not that guy, pal. And that's the thing, like, you think, like, oh, yeah, I'm going to go rob this woman's house. And you're not that guy.
No. They weren't that guy, that's for sure. But, so far, she's got a pretty good case for self-defense, right?
Yeah.
But that takes a turn. Instead of calling the police, she panics and she takes both of them, like, into her bathtub and dismembers them and tries to start, like, dumping them in pieces into the water. And while she's carrying, like, trash bags of them out there, she gets caught, like, red-handed. And, yeah.
You can get about halfway through a decapitation, and I'll still be like, maybe you were still acting in self-defense. You were in a fugue state. But if you get more than halfway through that, that feels hard.
Yeah.
Like,
I feel like it would take a while to dismember somebody.
Yeah.
I don't know that for sure, but I just imagine it would be a little bit of time that you could be like,
you'd want to have some tools.
Yeah. Well, so the prosecutors would have agreed with you all. And they made a case that her self-defense motive was a lie, that she did somehow lure them out there. She was convicted and sentenced to the gas chamber. But what's not... but that's not like what the legend says that happens.
Yeah.
According to like all the kids in town, you know, she escaped or something like that happened. And she's still like haunting the water, roaming the beaches, like hiding out in the bay somewhere. So she's like this monster. It's just out of sight just a little bit, right? That's the first story that he told in this book. That is his first book. And it got like... adapted into a movie, I think, or something like that. That's not the only like side story that we're going to talk about. You know, Devil House. Well, before we get into that, let's get our timeline straight, right? So the White Witch of Morro Bay, that takes place in the early 70s. Like, I want to say like 72, 73. I don't know exactly. Devil House takes place in the middle 80s, maybe a little bit toward the later 80s. And then the present, where our author is 2002. That's when he's like reminiscing about the White Witch and while he's investigating the Devil House murder. So Devil House murders took place in the 80s. He's investigating them in 2002.
Okay.
When we meet him, he's like at the height of his success. He's 37 years old. He's put out several more books since that first one we talked about. He gets a lead about the Devil House murders. He hears about it for the first time from his publisher. His publisher somehow got a hold of an old newspaper headline about this case that never like broke through to the national media, even though it really feels like it should have during the Satanic Panic, right? I'm going to read you a quote from the newspaper. It has like all these like classic elements. There's it's the 80s, of course. There's metal kids. There's a double murder. A quote from that old newspaper article goes like this, quote, "Bodies on top of a pile of pornography, cryptograms and symbols, and the specter of teenage satanic rituals jolting a sleepy town to attention." That has like Oprah, Geraldo, like that's all, that's got that shit just written all over it, right?
That headline's got Riz.
It does. That's going to be like on Ricky Lake. That's going to be on all those like daytime soapy TV shows. But it never broke through. And one of the reasons it never broke through is because it happened in a town called Milpitas, which is in California. I'm not sure if it's real or not. I don't care to find out because I just want to believe that it's real. I don't know where it is in relation to like San Luis Obispo or these other places, but Milpitas was the setting for another crime that actually did break through to some national attention about 5 years before the Devil House murders. And when I say Devil House, the house is an old house, and then it was converted into like several different businesses. Like a lot of like small town downtowns have those little houses that are like different things. So it's a house, but it was all these other things too. Before the Devil House murders happened, there was another one called the River's Edge murder. And with the River's Edge murder, it was this girl who was murdered by a boy. They were both in high school. And while the entire town is like looking for her, and the police are looking for her, and all the adults are in a panic, the boy who killed her actually like brings some of his friends out and shows them the body. And then those friends are like kind of freaked out, but they don't want to like tell him because they're kind of afraid of him. So they kind of vent about it to their friends, and then they bring their friends out to take a look at it. And before long, this entire high school knows exactly what happened to this girl, exactly where she is. A lot of them have been out there to look at her while the adults in town are still trying to figure out what happened. If she's still alive, if she isn't, is she missing, is she dead?
Yeah.
So it's like this, you can't trust the kids. It's a different kind of satanic panic, right? It's like that earlier version of it.
Yeah.
Where something was happening to the kids, right? So, and it's a it's an interesting take. And then we'll talk a little bit later on why the second murder in Milpitas didn't break through. But our author has this particular method, right? Most people will research a crime, maybe try and do some interviews, and then write a thing about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's got this method where he tries to really immerse himself in the world where the crime took place.
A method actor.
He's a method actor.
Yeah, it's like the worst of all worlds. Like writing about people's real crimes and you act like Jared Leto.
Yeah.
That's not good.
No, it's not good. So, the book, the murders took place while one of the iterations of this house was going on, and that iteration was a porn shop.
Mm-hmm.
So sometime in the 80s, a guy bought up the, or leased out the space. It'd been like converted and added on a little bit. It doesn't look like a house so much anymore, but you can tell what it used to be.
Yeah.
It's got big windows on the front that at the time had been like painted over. So you couldn't see inside from outside. But that house is up for sale. So our it's been converted back into a regular living space. Our author has the opportunity to actually move into where the murders happened. And now the place is up for sale. So he's going to do it.
That's definitely a back in the day story of like, oh, I want to investigate or I want to like immerse myself in this house. Let me just buy it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
And it would be one thing to buy it and like utilize it, but like to live in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's weird.
Yeah. Well, how far, how long have we been like going, Brooke?
We have been going for 38, probably more like 25 minutes, I guess.
25 minutes. Okay. Yeah. So, 25 minutes in, you know, we had some intro in there. Something that I want to point out is that this book is like packed with information. It's not dense as in it's difficult, but like everything has meaning in it. At this point, as I'm listening to the audiobook, we're on minute 12.
Oh.
So we are very early on. And there's a lot of information that we've already gotten. There's a lot of like cool, like intrigue that's already been built up. So I'm going to talk about the feel of the book for a little bit. Because I don't know, one of the things I love about it so much is like, it's got this broodiness, which I just love in my stories, right?
Yeah.
Love a good broody story. There's going to be a lot that I skip over because like to truly do it justice, I would just have to read you the book. So, like I say it every time, but get the book. You really want to read or listen to this one yourself. We're going to try and give you a good synopsis of it here, but man, it's just too much to really... to really do it justice. So also I'm going to like strongly recommend the audiobook because the author actually reads it, you know, and like you can tell sometimes when a narrator is just reading through the story and it's fine, but you can tell he knows exactly how he wants to like intonate each word and all that stuff. So it's good. It's just really good. All right.
Well, really quick before you get into, John Darnielle, we know you're listening. If you ever want to adapt this and do a, like a full production audio drama, let us know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we'd love, we would do it justice.
We would do it justice. All right, so we've hit on a lot already. Let's organize that info a little bit. One more time, White Witch of Morro Bay is in the 70s, Devil House in the 80s. Different parts of California. Our narrator is in the 2000s. All right. Our narrator also like begins to tell us like a little bit more about that method. So Typically, he's not moving into the actual place where a crime happened. But in past cases, he would like go to thrift stores and like try and buy things from that time period. And he would like deck out his entire house or space to look like that time period that the murder took place. He'll try and get his hands on like any true crime, like artifacts. You know, you've got a lot of people that like do that like macabre collecting thing where they'll like try and buy things that were actually like there when crimes happened. And he would like try and get his hands on that stuff if he could.
There are parts of that that are cool, like buying stuff from the time period I like, because I feel like that puts you in the headspace of a period you're not maybe familiar with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Buying the actual artifacts and living in the actual house is sort of different.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're getting into some mental space there that I'm not going to say is going to be real healthy for you in the long term. Yeah. Maybe.
I don't know if it's healthy for anybody involved.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But that's why true crime is like a, which I mean, obviously this is fake true crime. Because it's John Darnielle writing Gage, writing crime.
Right.
But that's why it's so like, the line is very much there for true crime.
Yeah.
So he would ordinarily like study blueprints and photographs, all the, like anything he can get his hands on, right? Not just evidence, not just photographs of the crime, but like if there's photographs that exist of that house, like just being lived in normally, you know?
Yeah.
He's looking for that stuff too. He obsesses over it to the point that when he arrives at the location, he wants it to feel less like being there for the first time and more like coming home. Right?
I dislike that.
Right?
My initial reaction to that is disgust.
Yeah. But then he can write about it as though he's writing about it from memory and not writing about it from like a cold, like whatever, right?
Yeah, but he isn't. I'm like,
no,
bro.
No, he's not.
It's like so, those people who go to those like extreme haunted houses.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So this time he's actually going to be able to move into the house. This is going to be a lot more intense. And he goes about the process of turning this house back into Devil House. Our narrator is... spending like a lot of time researching. He's telling us about the history of the house. And this is where we're going to go through those different iterations of it that I talked about, right? It's been a few different things at different points. So it was a lunch counter and a newsstand like back in the 40s. It went through a few different iterations as a restaurant. It became Monster Adult X in the late 70s.
Awesome Monster name. Adult X.
Oh man, the 70s were such an era. I bet it looked great.
We were
Monster Adult. We'll make shirts. Gosh dang.
So we're right off the freeway, right?
Yeah.
So this is almost like a trucker porn shop, right?
As most are, I
as
believe.
A card carrying member of the Lion's Den, off route, what the fuck ever it is, wherever you are, that is such a vibe.
On the way to Tennessee.
Yep.
So this is what the building is going to be for the purpose of our story, right? It's Monster Adult X. We learned that a woman named Evelyn Gates was one of the victims. She was the owner of the building that Monster Adult X was renting. So she owns the building. The porn shop is renting the building from her. Evelyn's body was found splayed on top of Mark Buckler. Mark Buckler was there to consider buying the building along with like a couple others. He had like anticipated, remember this is like the 80s, right? He'd anticipated that like Silicon Valley like boom, which I'm guessing Milpitas is like near that area. Mm. This is like on the outskirts, like further away from San Francisco where things are still a little bit cheap, but he's anticipating that it's going to, you know, really expand there. He's right, but obviously we're writing this in hindsight. So
yeah,
Evelyn's body was found on top of his. It happened on November 2nd, 1986, at 4 in the morning. Police cars pull up to Monster Adult X, what we're now calling Devil House. It's just after Halloween, and at first, the responding officers encounter what could be leftover Halloween decorations. There are broken bottles, jagged side up, buried down into the ground, so they're stuck in the ground with the bottoms broken off of them, like spiky, right? Someone had used accelerant to burn the shape of like some ancient runes into the concrete. Inside the store, the scene was even more like chaotic and sinister. There are these action figures with their heads twisted off. There are broken mirrors everywhere. There are things hanging from the ceiling, and all those racks of like VHS porn tapes and magazines have been scrawled on and defaced and otherwise just like thrown around the place. So they've like blotted out the eyes on people and stuff like that on all the covers. It's jarring, it's unsettling, and one of the cops thinks that they're seeing something move, and all of them just start opening fire.
Oh, God.
Oh, man.
Several of them will say that they saw this shadowy figure. There's a passage from our narrator that feels like, I don't know, like the jacket cover synopsis of this like final book called Devil House. For the sake of time, I'm just going to like skip over a lot, right? And of this like research and these conversations that he has with neighbors. Just so that you know, there's a lot there and it's all just really good. But the next thing that I'm going to read to you, like it gives you the impression that everything I've just told you has been prologue. Mm. What comes next reads like it's the jacket cover on that book, Devil House, that's going to be written and eventually published from all of this. This is where we get the feeling that everything is like really starting to move. So far, we've gotten like history of the house. We've gotten like a very brief overview of the murder itself. We've had a few conversations with neighbors that live around the house. He's moved into the place. He started doing some of his like rebuilding it into Devil House. And you really feel like the story's starting to get moving, and then you realize it hasn't at all.
Oh.
Okay. So I'm going to read this to you now. This is what feels like the prologue or the jacket cover for the book Devil House that he's working on. My name is Gage Chandler. I've been here for almost a year. I moved into this house to tell a story, to employ my usual and usually successful methods to the task, to inhabit the carapace of the crime scene, to retrace the steps of the killer, to better know his path. I've spoken to my neighbors, police, and any surviving relatives willing to speak to me. I went to high school and talked with teachers. I spoke with a caseworker who worked with Seth. Anyone who knew Derek and can still be found, I have located and never once taken no for an answer. I've charmed people when I could, played up my Hollywood friends when I had to, always finding a way to get them to talk. I did this with everybody. I gained access to police reports, reenacted scenes I wasn't present for. I unrolled Butcher's Block for days, drawing out maps and flowcharts to show me how things looked before I came here. And to light the path for me, for my rebuilding of a fortress that stood here for a brief time. Before it was made new and then made new again, cloaked in fresh paint by people who would like to erase 1986 from this neighborhood's history. I've surrounded myself with artifacts to keep the earlier days of this place vivid before me, to push back against the advancing crust of renovation. I've conjured the past in order to know more of the present. I know what happened here, and how what happened here differs in several important ways from the fragment that was unearthed to me, and what will happen if those differences are brought back into the light. What I've learned contradicts the account I first read, which I understand sprung from the need for a certain kind of telling, for a hunger for known quantities. I have combed every inch of ground where something dreadful happened some years ago, and it's now time for me to tell the story that I came here to tell. I don't want to do this, and I'm not going to do this. End quote. So it's heavy stuff, and it's also like, what do you mean you're not going to tell us? Right? It's a little weird.
What has happened in that year?
Yeah, no. What happened over this time? So like we're about to get started, and then we jump to I've been here a year, right? So a lot has happened in the meantime. A lot of cryptic stuff going on. I don't know. All right. So pretty heavy stuff. This is where it like really gets moving. And before we get moving, can we stop and talk about some of my favorite quotes and lines so far in this book?
Yeah.
Like this is stuff that we've glossed over, but I want to go back and talk about what I mean by that broodiness and just, I don't know, so much of it is just beautiful. Like I said before, it's like dense with meaning. It strikes like a perfect balance between being perfectly digestible while, like, I don't know, just being so poetic. There are these like throwaway lines that, I don't know, would be like the best part of any other book, but they're just throwaway lines for him sometimes. I don't know. For example, in the middle of this whole thing about the evolution of the building that became Devil House, he just throws out this thing where he says California has a way of erasing its own history.
Oh, man.
Right?
That's really good.
That's good, right?
Yeah.
He's talking about like memory, and there's this line that says, you know, there's ample space in the brain for several worlds to occupy at once.
I like that.
He does this thing throughout that I'm not going to talk about a whole lot, but he almost like goes into like a fantasy world with, he likes to like think about things and like entertain himself in his idle moments by thinking about like dragon stories from when he was a kid, and he'll like put real people into it. So like he'll be talking to a neighbor and like the neighbor's a knight or something like that. And it's not confusing. You don't need it. We're not going to talk about it very much, but it's just kind of fun. And that's where he's talking about, like, there's so much space for like several worlds to occupy at one time. You can be a serious person doing serious work, and you can also pretend there are dragons.
Yeah, that's very good.
It's so cool. When he's talking about his method, he says it appears. He's talking about his method. He says it matters. This is where we're talking about like how he recreates everything.
Mm-hmm.
He says it matters whose air I'm breathing. I don't know, just shit like that all throughout the book. So speaking of things that erase their own history, did you know that podcast ads are like contracted out and assigned to all your favorite shows by hosting sites? We have no idea what ads are going to play anytime that we throw to like an ad break. A lot of times we'll never know because they're here, that contract runs up and it's replaced by someone else. So as we talk about things that erase their own history, enjoy these advertisements.
Woo!
All right, we're back. And we left off at the end of a description of the crime scene and like a statement from the author about how the story he discovered wasn't what he first thought it would be, right?
And he also told us he wasn't going to tell it to us.
Well, so sort of, you know, like he's saying that like this story needed a certain kind of telling because of the time it was in. And he's found some deeper stuff, I think, you know? I don't know. We'll see. We still don't know, like, what happened or who did it, right? We know the outcome. We know that two people died. We don't know who did it. We don't know why. We're going to get into it. We're about, like, 20% of the way through the book at this point, by the way. So
okay. We've
got a lot to go. In the meantime, we're going to take, like, a little detour into part two. That was the end of part one. Part two is pretty much entirely about that first book that he wrote that was really successful, The White Witch of Morro Bay. I don't know. It's just so good. In part two, we're going to get our first like real linear narrative in this book. We jumped around a whole lot to different places in part one. We're going to get a nice beginning to end story here.
Cool.
So I'm going to almost completely withhold this from you because it is not our main storyline, but I do want to like just touch on it a little bit because it's so beautiful in a lot of ways. The part two is entitled The White Witch, and it's about that first case like we were talking about. This is the 1970s, the early 70s, in San Luis Obispo, not in Milpitas. It's not connected to Devil House at all, so we're not looking for connections, but it does like impact and inform our author. There is something really interesting in part two because the entire thing is told as if our author is speaking directly to the woman who becomes the White Witch.
Oh.
Like to her and about her. Hmm. He doesn't refer to her by her name, but he says you a lot, you know, like you're going to do this. You were doing this. You were doing this,
that's,
you know,
heartbreaking.
It's it just rips your fucking soul out. I don't know how to explain it. It's just, it's heartbreaking, but it also like instills this dread.
Yeah.
There's both of those things happening at once. So this part opens with the woman that we'll come to know as the White Witch of Morro Bay going about her day at the end of the school year. She's a teacher, remember? So there's this like excitement in the air because summer's almost there. It's very carefree. Everyone's just kind of breezing through the day, right? I actually like imagine open windows with a nice breeze, you know, through the classrooms, like empty classrooms, you know, that kind of thing. After we go through that day at school, like a lot of the coworkers that work with her are like people that would have been like hippies a few years before and stuff like that. You know, they're dressed like teachers, but they've got that kind of like, I don't know, a little bit of edge to them or whatever.
It's a vibe.
Yeah. Where we get to like that part about instilling dread. This is a direct quote from that passage or from that part of the book. Remember, he's referring to her as you, right?
Mm.
So he says that, he says, you turn the key and enter the small world that you've made for yourself inside your apartment. There will be much talk in the days to come about the inside of your apartment. There's something in this like part two that I love so much. And it has nothing to do with like anything, but like there's just this little restaurant by the bay and there's this seal inside of a cage out front and it's kind of like on display, right? You know, like, I don't know, it's just like a seal in a tank on this little like boardwalk. There's this passage about how this seal must be so sad because it's so close. It can smell the sea breeze.
Yeah.
It can smell the ocean, but it can never go home. It'll never experience where it's supposed to be. But anyway, that's enough about part two. Read the book if you want to read more into it. It's just fucking beautiful and devastating. And after this comes a description of the attack itself where the two boys break into her apartment. It is fucking gnarly. It's rough, but I'm not going to go into it here. Now, we're going to get back into the story of Devil House in part three. And part three, like part two, is going to be a linear story. So we're going to hear it from beginning to end. Here we go. We're going back to the 80s.
All right.
Let's do it.
Derek is the main character that we're going to follow. He works at Monster Adult X, but he doesn't have like a regular shift. Derek is a kid. He's like 17. He's a high schooler. He kind of just like comes and goes as he wants. Derek is the kind of kid that like keeps busy. When he finishes something, he finds something else to do. He doesn't like sitting and being alone. When he runs out of things to do, he packs up and he just goes home, right? I say Derek is a kid because he's literally a kid. He's 17. He probably shouldn't be working in an adult bookstore, right?
Yeah,
definitely not.
But this is the 1980s and yeah, there's a... That's just how things work.
Yep.
Yeah.
Also, Derek has like managed to hide this job from his mom for obvious reasons, right? Derek's boss is Anthony, and both Anthony and Derek are like pretty ambivalent to the merchandise, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like they might as well just be like working at a convenience store with like snacks on the shelf. Like,
yeah.
they're not like gross or like whatever. That isn't to say that like Derek is like uninterested in that stuff, but it just like not the stuff in the store, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. He's also just like he sees it every day and it just kind of becomes a little bit boring.
Yeah.
One day his boss comes into the store and he tells Derek that he's thinking about closing it down and finding something else to do. He's tired of like creepy customers. He's tired of cleaning up the video booths.
Yeah.
He's just ready for a change. But Derek kind of like reflexively protests. It's his first job. And for some reason, he has this like sentimental attachment to the place. Working here had like given him some freedom. Also, working in a place like this, despite like all the gross parts of the job, he kind of felt like it was like a fuck you to the man kind of thing. You know, Derek is like a little bit of a metal kid. He's he's one of those guys. So
he's a teenager.
Yeah. Anthony said that, you know, it wouldn't be right away if he does close it down. It's going to take some time. Told Derek not to worry. Also tells Derek, like, look, kid, any job that you get after this job is going to be a better job than this job.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I know
you
this
You never realize that while you're in it, though.
Yeah.
Right. And it's like, this is your first job. You have no idea. This is also probably going to be your worst job. You know?
For sure.
Anyway, you know, we kind of like him. We kind of like the boss.
Yeah.
Even though he's like employing a literal child in his porn shop, he doesn't seem like he's being exploitative or anything like that. Anthony, the boss, the guy that owns Monster Adult X, he hates the landlord, Evelyn, right? So he also like doesn't really want Derek, this child, doing gross things like cleaning up the video booths. I don't know. He plans to just like, he tells Derek to stop cleaning anything up. He stops telling him to like whatever. When he does close this place down, he wants to leave it an absolute disaster. Yeah. It's like a fuck you to the landlord who's like raised his rent like four times this year. And
honestly,
you know, who can't relate to that, right? Let's talk about Derek a little bit. Derek's kind of a rebel. He's like a little bit of a metal D&D kid, but he's not like a real troublemaker, right? Derek spends a lot of time in his head. We meet his mom, and Derek might be like a rebel in a lot of ways, but he's really not a rebel with her. There's a lot of like genuine love and endearment there. And there's this little bit where our narrator talks about Derek's mom coming to terms with her son growing up and having to let go and letting him start to take care of himself. She's divorced. This is the era where divorce is starting to become common, but it's not quite there yet. It's not something that people think of as normal yet, right?
Yeah.
This passage ends with this little bit where it says, quote, Diana Hall was different from a lot of parents in a lot of ways, but not in this one. So some time passes in talking about, you know, him getting older and leaving, you know. So time passes, the store closed down. Derek is riding his bike past it on the way to school one day, and a thought occurs to him, and he takes out his old key to the place and decides to give it a try, and it still works. He goes around back, opens the door, and inside, nothing has changed. The landlord hadn't done anything with the place yet. It's been closed for a little while. All the merchandise was still in there. So later that day at school, we're introduced to Derek's friend, Seth. Now, remember, our narrator has talked about both of these people in that little prologue, right? He talked about like a counselor that worked with Seth, and then like anyone who knew Derek, he's found and talked to. So he's talking to his friend, Seth. We know that from foreshadowing earlier in the book, he's going to be involved in this somehow. After school, Derek and Seth stop by, and he shows him the inside of Monster Adult X. For the next little while, Monster Adult X is going to become kind of like a treehouse for Derek and Seth and their friends, right?
Yeah.
It's a fort. It's a little hideout. It's a place where these kids can go and, have a place of their own. So, Brooke, Bridget, a while back, we talked about Prayer House versus Wolf House. Monster Adult X, Prayer House or Wolf House?
You would think it would be easy. But
it's not.
It's not.
It's not easy.
Let's talk about iconography.
Mm-hmm.
A porn shop has iconography. I mean, like, they all look the same. And you know what you're going to find. And it's not even about what you like. It's about what has to be there,
yeah.
I feel like.
See, the thing about it is, too, because, like, in this book, I've been thinking about Wolf House and Prayer House while we've been talking about this book. And as I believe I said earlier, it kind of reminds me of you and my older brother, Eric, because Eric was very much Wolf House and you were more Prayer House. But I can see both iterations of children going to this house.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, we'll come back to the idea of whether our porn shop tree house is a prayer house or a wolf house. But the next question that I want to ask is, what do you think about these acts? All right, we're back, and we've had some time to think about Wolf House, Prayer House for our porn shop tree house. What do we think?
So, I'm not saying that, is it what Monster X?
Monster Adult X.
Monster Adult X. I'm not saying that Monster Adult X doesn't have elements of Wolf House. However, it is so Prayer House to like find some dead bodies and some occult shit. It's also Wolf House, but I'm just going to say that this like actual murder feels Prayer House. And then, you know.
It's ritual. It's yeah. There's stuff going on.
For the face you're making, I thought you were like, spoilers. And I was like, oh my God, did we not talk about that?
Oh, really?
Yeah, it feels really ritualistic. It's not messy enough. It feels like it all fits together too well.
All right. Well, things are going to get a little messy. Oh, Bridget, what Lord. Do you think?
I'm agreeing with Brooke. I really feel like, but then I also feel like Monster Adult X could be the bridging gap between the two houses.
Okay.
That it is very, that no matter which house you were at,
mm-hmm.
going to Adult Monster X or Monster Adult X or mm-hmm. X Adult Monster, I don't know. I keep trying to remember the order in my head.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter at the end of the day, right? Any of those things in any order really works.
It all works for being an adult bookstore. Yeah. But yeah, that is the gap between.
And you know what? Like our narrator, when we go to Monster Adult X, it should feel like we're coming home.
There you go. All right. That's sweet. That's very nice. Well, we left off. Derek, Seth, and their friends are coming to use Monster Adult X as their secret place, their treehouse, their fort. But there are other people who claim ownership over this space. We've already met those people, right? Evelyn Gates is the property owner. We're about to meet Mark Buckner and another one of Derek's friends, Alex. So Mark is a prospective buyer. He wants to jump into a real estate market that he thinks is going to really explode around San Francisco. So I guess Milpitas is near San Francisco. He's one of those people who can like sense that something's about to happen in the Bay Area, and he's looking to get in on it early, right?
Mm-hmm.
We encounter them for the first time when Evelyn takes Mark around town, showing him different properties that she wants to sell off. Mark is nervous. This is actually his first time trying to buy up any investment property, and he doesn't know if he's doing it right, you know? He doesn't know how to handle himself. He's anxious and like worried that he's going to do something wrong and give her an opening that she could use to like negotiate prices upward, or that he's going to like really focus on the wrong kind of provisions that'll cost him a lot of money over time, stuff like that. They visit the pawn shop, and it's like, at this point, already been occupied by the kids, and they can tell that it's been occupied by the kids, but they think it might just be like one-off vandalism, right? You know, it's an abandoned pawn shop. It's a magnet for kids to try and break into, right?
Oh, yeah.
So they don't know that this is like an ongoing thing. They think that this is just something that maybe happened once and the damage is still there, the evidence is still there, but, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. It's in the middle of the school day, so the kids are at school, but we did mention that one of Derek's friends, Alex, was going to be joining the story. Alex is a runaway. He's not in school, and he is spending the day at Monster Adult X while the other kids are at school, right?
Mm.
Alex is in the back when Evelyn and Mark come in. What they don't know is that he's listening in, and he's heard them talking about selling the place. He's hiding in like one of the video booths in the back of the store. They don't go all the way back there and look around. All he knows is that there's a guy trying to buy the place, and now there's a chance that they're going to lose their spot, Monster Adult X, right?
Mm-hmm.
Derek hears about this, and like when he learns that this is happening, he tries to shut the whole thing down, right? Because when they come back, you know, like later on after school, Alex is like, holy shit, guys. Some people came in, they're trying to sell the place. Some guy's going to like buy it and tear it down and build some houses or something. Derek's like, well, that's it. It's fun while it lasted. It's over now, guys. But, you know, I don't know. They've seen what they've done with the place. They know that people have been coming in here. You know, Derek has got a pretty good head on his shoulders.
Yeah.
Right? So like Derek is like, you know, they could be calling the cops. The cops could be watching the place now that they know someone's been breaking into it. Something that I haven't mentioned yet is that Derek's mom is kind of like guiding him through applying for colleges. And when Derek gets home, there are like new applications out for him to fill out every day. And Derek's filling them out and like mailing them in. Derek looks around at his friends and he has this like sinking feeling. You know, Derek is a rebel, but Derek is going to move past this, right? Mm-hmm. And Derek knows that he's going to move past this. But deep down, he knows that he's not like his other friends. He's not like a real troublemaker. Seth and Alex, these are both like dropouts.
Mm-hmm.
He knows that once he leaves town and goes to college, their paths are probably going to diverge forever. And it's something that he dreads and that he like experiences a lot of guilt over in this moment before it even happens, right?
Mm-hmm.
Another friend of theirs, Angela, found out that Alex was back in town. They had been really close childhood friends. So Angela and comes to Monster Adult X one night looking for him. She finds him there. Seth is also there. And Derek's at home. She was glad to see like her old friend Alex again, but she didn't care much for Seth. And she really didn't care that much for Monster Adult X, you know, hanging out in the porn shop. It's during this like little visit while Angela's there that Seth starts going on about how they're about to lose the place, about how it's all going to be ruined. And they hatch this plan to turn the inside of the store into a kind of scarecrow, something wild and horrific for when people like who would destroy this place for them finally arrive. It'll be this scene that like either scares them off or like makes them town legends forever. Right. Into like, you know, I don't know. This is that scene that I think we're describing earlier when the police walk in, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they find the bodies, the way that everything's been like.
The eyes are all blacked out.
The eyes are blacked out. I think at some point, I think it's maybe later on in my notes, but they hang this mannequin from the ceiling and they like dress it up like this dark angel.
Uh-huh.
You know, like this just, it's so like fucking like 1980s metal kid stuff, you know. When Derek comes back around like the next day and he sees what they've done and they've just like started, right, he's like really impressed, but he's still like, guys, come on, you know, this is over, right? There's a divide between Alex and Seth and Derek and Angela are like kind of on the same page. You know, Angela doesn't like the space. Derek is like, this isn't gonna last, guys, let's just move on. Seth and Alex have like put their feet down, right? Mm. For them, this is like a home or a refuge, right? For Derek, this is just a hangout. So there's real pain and there's real anger about losing this space. And you remember when you're like a teenager and you have no foresight, you have no like bigger picture, you know? That's where they are. They're tunnel visioned. They're focused in. There's a long description of like everything that they did inside the space. Every wall has like a drawing on it. They put these mosaics made out of broken beer bottles and glass and mirror all over the place. There's like this giant spray painted mannequin that they've made into this dark angel, like hanging from the ceiling. There's so much more that they do. Honestly, it's pretty fucking cool. They leave like several movies playing in the back of the booths. And they're on these VCRs that'll just repeat them, right? It's not just porn movies, but there's like horror movies, set to like automatically rewind and restart. It's a really fun read, like listening to everything that they're doing. They work on it all together for like a couple more days, Alex, Seth, Derek, Angela. This is their like final night in the shop. It's the way that they're going to leave it. It's like this legacy that will like only exist for a short time. But it'll be like a time that it was entirely theirs and no one else's, right? So the people who find this, you know, they'll be talking about it for years to come. You know, they want to be town legends about this. So anyway, they want it to be like a ghost story.
This is so like coming of age.
Isn't it? It's so great. It's so, I'm not doing, I keep like, I feel like I'm trying to over explain it because I'm not doing it justice. But yeah, it's so cool. Anyway, when they finish, they pack up their things and they like reluctantly leave and move on. Their hope is that, you know, what they've left behind when it's found, you know, it'll be on the local news. It'll freak out the squares and all that stuff. It's going to do a lot more than that.
Right.
While they're packing up and leaving across town, the building's owner, Evelyn, and that same real estate investor that we were talking about, Mark Buckner, they are on their way back to have a second look at the porn shop. Brooke, Bridget, what are we thinking and like how are we feeling about this little turning point in the story here?
I would love to stop. What's the woman's name?
Evelyn.
Evelyn and Mark from coming back to the porn shop.
Yeah.
Just because I know from what we've said about the story in the beginning that this is not going to end well for them.
It is not. So we know that they're going to die in this shop. We have our four angsty 80s metal kids packing up, getting ready to leave. Are they going to be able to leave in time before they get there? Who knows? Here at Edging Podcast, we don't like to give away the ending of the story. We want to, you know, we want you to read the books. We want you to enjoy the same things that we enjoy. If you like the way that this is shaping up, pick it up at a bookstore, a library, listen to it, whatever you want to do. Give the author, John Darnielle, a lot of love because this is one of my favorite books ever. I'm going to go ahead and give away my ending rating. Did we rate it at all?
We did rate it, didn't we?
We gave it all, that's right.
I am about to tell Brooke and Bridget the rest of the story. We're only about halfway through at this point, by the way. So we are not at the ending. If you want to hear what happens next, find us on Patreon at patreon.com/edgingthepodcast. patreon.com/edgingthepodcast. All right. Are we ready?
Let's go.
Let's go.
That part was intended to like freak him out, and it does. By the way, this is a porn shop with carpet in those video bins.
It was this. Ugh. It was the time.
Yeah. Fuck.
I feel like I gotta read this book.
Yeah. I am intrigued by the book. I am angry.
Yeah, you should be angry.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm pissed.
So what does this mean? Like, giving away a little bit of what we talked about during the Patreon only section. What is like, so what we learn in our ending here, what does that mean about the White Witch of Morro Bay? That letter that he got from that, that dead kid's mom, right? You know?
Yeah.
So like, yeah, so much of this book is like about the past and how it changes in our minds as we get further from it.
Yeah.
How it's so much like harder to hold on to what was real.
Mm-hmm.
I think I like this book so much because it's like, it's got these like themes that I use in my own writing for 13, right? They sound like really familiar to any 13 listeners out there. There's one more passage that I have held off on that I wanted to save for the ending because it sums up the whole thing so well. In its original context, it's like when the narrator goes back to his childhood home. So this is the quote. To gaze upon a childhood home with adult eyes is to engage in an act of disenchantment. Great doors grow small, turrets vanish, emblems fray. Even if the time spent within any given set of walls was brief, it's in the nature of childhood to gild all surfaces it touches, to magnify things. One should revisit such places only after having done some hard calculations. What are we willing to trade for a clear view of things? What are the chances we'll regret the bargain later on?
That's so good.
Right?
But also...
And that's the quote that I sent to Catherine, my friend, and she was like, holy shit, is that John Darnielle from the Mountain Goats?
Yeah, that's... I feel like that quote does sum up everything from what you've told us, and it also... really characterizes the main character of the book.
Yeah. One should revisit such places only after having done some hard calculations. What are we willing to trade for a clear view of things? What are the chances we'll regret the bargain later on? Like, holy shit, right?
Mm-hmm.
You lose the magic. You can't hold on to the magic.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's Devil House.
That's Devil House.
I mean, still full pizza.
Yeah, maybe honestly, like I'm thinking a 2 for $6.99 Domino's deal. Give me a couple 2 toppings and We're eating for a couple days. I'm in it.
But don't send a breakup pizza to your boyfriend or girlfriend or anyone like that. Don't do that. Don't do that to your delivery driver. Grow the fuck up.
Break you know up what? In person.
Bring a pizza. Go pick up a fucking pizza and bring it to somebody's house.
Be a fucking adult. Anyway, that's edging.
That's edging.
All right.
See y'all.
Bye.